Hello, everyone, and welcome to Digital Roadmap, an old-school gaming podcast where we explore how the games of the past brought us the games we love today. I'm your host, Grant, and this episode we're discussing Diablo from Blizzard Entertainment, more specifically Blizzard North. Released New Year's Eve of 1996, this game built the foundation of the action RPG genre we discussed in the last episode. At its core, this game is all about loot grinding, hack and slash, dungeon crawling, but it's the one that spawned a brand that's still popular today and really established this formula that's become so popular. As always, when we're talking about games on this show, there's going to be spoilers involved. Everything's old enough now that I'm not really too worried about giving them, but here's your spoiler warning now. Now, the controls for this game are very straightforward. You basically use your mouse and a little bit of keyboard. Your left mouse button is for attack. Your right mouse button is for any special skills you've queued up. 1 to 8 across the top of your keyboard, that's going to be your quick slot option, so you're going to get your healing, your mana scrolls, your potions, your spells, any scroll-based spells that you have on hand, that's what that's going to be used for. In terms of queuing up special attacks, mostly through spells, either that or a class-specific skill, you can actually assign them to the function keys, F1, F2, so on and so forth, so that you can easily switch quickly between them. Now, just like most action RPGs, the story in this game gets ignored fairly often, but I think the Diablo stories are actually fairly well done, so they deserve a little bit of recognition. At its foundation, you are coming back to your hometown of Tristram, ruled over by King Leoric. His son's actually been taken by the soul of the Lord of Terror. Your understanding is he's just been kidnapped. You don't realize he's been taken over yet. And you've come home to try and help clear out the church of all the hellspawn that are down there. Lots have tried. You're going to find bodies of dead adventurers down there, so you know they've tried. Nobody has succeeded yet. It's kind of up to you. The town itself's been abandoned, except for maybe a small handful of helpful and determined people that are still around. We'll talk about those when we talk about the characters, because each one of them has their own nice personality that they have. One of the interesting things is this game was actually retconned later on, so that it wasn't just a member of the town coming back. You're actually the older son of Leoric, the king, coming back to try and help save your younger brother. Considering how Diablo kind of set the tone for this whole genre, it makes sense that this is very fundamental. This is very much what would now be a by-the-numbers gameplay routine for this game. So you have your hub town of Tristram, which is where you get your repairs, you get your quests, or at least most of your quests. You get items identified, any of your magic items that you don't know what they do, and you can buy and sell your items. In this town, each kind of core task is taken care of by a specific character. You have Adria the Witch, and she sells your staves, she recharges your staves, sells some scrolls, sells mana potions. As you get higher level, she'll sell you some books for spells as well. You have Griswold the Blacksmith. He basically takes care of weapons, armor, enchanted gear, and he'll repair and buy all of those items off of you as well. Next up, you have Pepin the Healer. He basically will give you a heal when you come to town. He'll also sell you healing potions, rejuvenation potions. And then the last of the core useful ones is Deckard Cain, who is basically your lore master of the game. He knows all the trivia, all the information about it. He also has the ability to identify all your items for you. There is one other character that has a level of usefulness. I refer to it as the gambling option. His name's Wurt the Peg-Legged Boy. He actually got his leg ripped off by a demon in the game, so it's a bit of a hard luck story. The reason I call him a gambler is because you have to pay 50 gold to even see what he has in his inventory for sale. And it's going to be completely random what he's got. It's random enchanted gear that you have no idea what it's going to be. You don't know if it's going to be useful for your class at all. You're just taking the chance by seeing what he has in him. On top of that, you also have Ogden, who's a tavern owner. He'll give you a few small quests and a bit of information. Farnham, the town drunk, he's mostly there for flavor. He was a survivor of the earlier foray into the dungeon that happened. He's the only one who survived. And then you have Jillian, the barmaid, who kind of worries about Farnham and is just that caring, motherly figure that's around the game. The other fun with all these characters, every single one of them, they have town gossip. And if you have a quest, they'll give you some sort of opinion on it. Whether it's useful or not, they'll have some sort of info there for you available. Now, when you leave the town and you get into the actual dungeon crawling, the basic gameplay is kill everything around you. Kill everything that moves. You will never find allies down in that dungeon. If it moves, it's going to try and hurt you. Now, this game itself, and it's a little shocking for me to go back and realize this, but it is only 16 floors deep, the whole thing. You get a few sub-levels in there, but they're more like an offshoot map for a particular quest. But you have the first four levels, which are the church. The next four, which are the catacombs. The third four are caves that have a lot of lava in them. They're just shy of being in hell. And then the final levels are all hell, with the only fixed layout in this entire game, outside of the town itself, it's gonna be the final dungeon. It's the final level. It's your final fight against Diablo and all of his minions. Now, while you're exploring the dungeons, while you're crawling through there, everybody's going to be dropping everything for you. You're going to get random gear. You're going to get money. You're going to get potions. There's going to be a few things you can interact with, too. You're going to have exploding barrels, some that don't explode, but most of the time they're going to explode on you. You're going to have sarcophaguses, crypts, that you can open up. A lot of the time you're going to see a skeleton monster of some sort pop out of them that you have to fight. You're going to get chests. Some of them and some of the doors in this game are trapped, so you have to watch out for that because they will hurt you. And then you also have tomes and libraries that are going to give you more scrolls, are going to give you a lot of books that you can use. And at the end of all that, you have the shrines of information, shrines of power. So they're either going to, for example, they're going to turn all your potions into rejuvenation potions instead of just mana or health, which will heal both. They're going to give you the full map of the level that you're on. They're going to power you up for a little bit, maybe give you an experience boost. So the key thing being, keep an eye out while you're down there, keep your eye looking around, and always, always, always carry Scrolls of Town Portal with you, because it's the only way you're going to get back to the surface without completely backtracking on everything you've done. Now, mechanically for this game, as I've said with everything else, it really set the standard, so it may seem cliche in hindsight, but at the time this was all very much, not quite revolutionary, but definitely establishing something that hadn't been common at the time. So when you first start the game, you're going to have to pick between three classes, a warrior, a rogue, or a sorcerer. Obviously, you've got kind of the core concepts already in the name. The warrior is going to be good for just going toe-to-toe, beating stuff up, hurting everybody. The rogue is more of a ranged attacker. You kind of want to hold back on them. And the sorcerer is just pure magic. The sorcerer, for the most part, can be equipped in a way where it's just a broken character and that you can just ease through the game, no problem with it. In terms of gaining experience and leveling up, it's a very straightforward mechanic. You kill more creatures. You kill creatures after that, you kill more. Periodically, you'll complete a quest. Gives you some experience, but for the most part, quests are there to give you gear. You get enough experience, you level up. Now, when you level up, this is a little bit different from most games that have come since. You get 5 points to spread around 4 different stats. In the game, you have strength, magic, dexterity, and vitality. And every level, you get 5 points. So a lot of the time, the way I typically play is I'll put 2 into my main stat and then 1 into the other 3. Now, at the same time, each class does have an upper limit on their stats. So the warrior can keep pumping a ton of stats into strength, but not so much into magic because they're not a magic character. So they'll cap out early on that. Sorcerers, the other way around, they can keep pumping into magic, but they won't have a lot of strength. This may not seem that important at the time. This may seem like just a style aspect, but all the magic spells, all the armor types, and all the weapon types do have a required stat as you get more powerful versions of them. So, for example, physical weapons are going to have a higher strength stat. More powerful ranged weapons will have a higher dexterity stat. Magical staves, magical staffs will have a higher magic stat. So you can't necessarily equip everything. You can definitely have a warrior that is able to use magic, but they'll never be as powerful a magic user as the sorcerer is. They'll still have to rely on their physical aspects, or they're going to have a harder time doing it. As I said earlier, to get gear in this game, you either need to kill creatures or find them in chests. You're going to get a few quest rewards, but even then, that usually involves killing something. When they drop magical items, blue items, they're not going to tell you what their stats are on it. They're not going to tell you what their skills are, what perks you're going to get. You have to identify that item in order to use it. Again, a lot of this has become very common since. In this game, you either go back to town, get Deckard Cain to identify them for 100 gold each, or you use a scroll of identify that you're going to find down in the tomb somewhere. For the combat in this game, it basically operates on a one click equals one swing. So you click once, you swing once, you click again, you swing again. Later games, of course, establish that you just have to hold down the attack button. It makes life a lot easier. But all the damage, all the odds that you're going to hit, all the odds you're going to do a critical hit are all based on your stats. So again, strength increases damage, dexterity increases, you know, hit odds, that kind of thing. One of the most frustrating parts of this game, one of the things that they didn't do as deeply later on, it's possible to get stun locked in this game. So you can get surrounded by enemies, or you can be up against a fast enough moving enemy that they will keep hitting you, and you will go through a stun animation. You will go through an animation of getting hit that you will not be able to get out of, because they will hit you again before you can get out of that and take a swing yourself. Especially on the early levels where you have minimal defense, minimal hit recovery on your items, this becomes very frustrating and very challenging. I would recommend playing the first couple floors a minimum of 2, maybe 3 times before you try and face the butcher, just so you have a chance to kind of counterbalance his attacks. The quests in this game, some of them are fixed. So you have quests like taking down the butcher, taking down Diablo, the Skeleton King. Those are typically fixed quests in the game. You're going to come across them every time you play. Some of them are random, though. There's a few that you get. The one that I always loved growing up was the Poisoned Well, because you would load up your game, walk up into town, walk up to Deckard Cain. You're going to know right away if you have that quest as an option, because the well would be, instead of being a blue water, it'll be like a yellow putrid water. And these random quests do open up different areas. They do establish different parts of the dungeon that you need to use. And it's just, it creates a little bit of a replay value. It's very entertaining that way to do. You don't know what you're going to get. You can go in, keep grinding it. As I said before, there's one fixed floor of the dungeon, and that is the very last floor. Every other floor is randomly generated in each new game you play. So you load up a game, go down to the first floor, quit that game, start a new game, same character, but a new game altogether. It's not going to be the same layout on the first floor. Same with all the subsequent floors. As you go on, it's all randomly generated. Again, this helps for replay value. It's not just follow the fixed path through the whole time. For the graphics in this game, it's very straightforward. It's a fixed isometric view, so it's that kind of bird's eye view down on you like you would see similar to real-time strategy games, but a bit closer. It does include a bit of a dithering of the wall, so as you go behind a wall, it'll fade slightly, but not completely. Just so you can kind of see what's there, you can get a bit of a better idea of what you're going up against. That being said, it is very dark game. It's a very dark game. There's actually a stat that you can use on items to increase your light radius so you can see better. This gives it a very atmospheric feel. This definitely plays into the aesthetic that they were going for in the first game. The one downside of that is, in this one, in Diablo 1, there was no highlighting of items on the ground. If you had something drop, you had to remember where it was, or you had to slowly scan around pixel hunting like a friggin' adventure game just to find that item that had dropped, because not all of them were visible. Gold you can see easily. It's a big yellow pile. But if it was a staff or a dagger, good luck finding it down there. All the cast in this game does have a set voice actor on them. They have a personality. They have gossip that they give out. Everybody deserves their respect. Most of the key villains even have a fixed voice actor, so you'll get one, two, maybe three lines out of them at least, just so you have a personality to go with that character. I'm going to give shout out to one actor in particular in this. It's Michael Goh. He did the voice of Deckard Cain, and he has played the role throughout the entire franchise. The character's become something of a love-hate for some of the community, only because he has one line that you hear every time you talk to him, and they carried it on throughout the entire series. But there's so much personality behind him, and there's so much character to him. You can't help but love him. I've always loved Cain, and I just think what he did and the very distinctive, very unique, very established character that he did right throughout the franchise really deserves him getting some extra respect for it. At this point, I really do want to talk about the soundtrack for the game. Matt Ullman was the composer, and he made a complete feel for it. You can't hear some of the music in this game without getting chills if you played it back in the day. It's so atmospheric. It is so appropriate for each individual scene that you're in. It focuses on the acoustics. I don't think there's really any brass or definitely no electric stuff. It was all kind of strings, maybe a little bit of piano in there. And it just really set such an atmospheric feel for it. I'm going to link to some of it in the show notes just to stress how strong of a feeling you can get from this music. Honestly, the Tristram theme alone, I still think of it every time I walk into a town in any type of ARPG, because it is the first strings you hear once you start a new game that it is, it just fills you with that feeling of adventure. Diablo, right from the get-go, used multiplayer. It used the Battle.net system of multiplayer, which up until recently was the name of Blizzard's standalone launcher that they had as well, was Battle.net. One of the things with the multiplayer, though, is part of it was handled client-side. It was handled on the computer that you were using as well, not just 100% on their servers. This allowed for a few glitches, a few exploits that people ended up using very commonly, such as the item duplication glitch, which allowed you to create a copy of an item for basically the cost of a health potion. This didn't matter too much, but it did take out a lot of the grinding element where you could hop online and all of a sudden 50 of the best armors, 50 of the best rings are just laying on the ground for anybody to grab in a multiplayer game because somebody's created a whole whack of them. In the multiplayer itself, it did have an optional PvP element. You could throw player versus player content on. Part of the fun of that, though, is when you killed a character or got killed, there was an ear on the body as a trophy. So if you were a high-level character who's renowned on the servers, who's renowned on the forums as being somebody everybody wanted to try and take down, if somebody killed you, they could take the ear off of your body as a trophy to kind of show off and go, yes, I did beat them. One of the other things this game didn't have, and it's very noticeable going back, it's very challenging to deal with going back, it did not have a speed option. You could not run in any way, shape, or form. You were stuck walking everywhere. this may not seem like that big of a deal. It may seem like, oh, it's just a standard speed, but when you've gone to play Diablo 2 and Diablo 3 and go back to this, it is such a noticeable difference in speed that it is just frustrating, and it is probably the biggest challenge for me playing it at all. One of the really fascinating, really interesting things this game did, it put out an expansion pack, which on its own isn't that fascinating, I know, but it wasn't developed by Blizzard. There was an expansion pack put out called Hellfire that was created by a division of Sierra Online, Sierra Games, we'll look at mostly for their adventure game series that they've done. This was just bizarre. The expansion packs were always done in-house or done by a sister studio in the same company. You would at least have the name attached to it. But this was completely farmed out, completely shopped out to another company altogether. What it did do, though, and it did some interesting things, it added in some extra levels, basically a whole new zone for you to fight in. It gave a new class, the Monk, gave you some new items, some new item types, so you had some better armor, you had some better weapons. You also had oils that you could use to improve your weapons, kind of a bomb item that you could throw. And it added in highlighting of items on the ground. You could finally push a button and an outline would appear around anything on the ground. And this became very much a standard later on. This basically answered one of the big complaints that was going on in the game as well. Being a game from Blizzard Entertainment, this game had a phenomenal manual attached to it. The whole first section of the manual, of course, dealt with character classes, how to play the game, the types of items you're going to find throughout it. It didn't show you exact details on every single weapon in the game, mostly because the random nature of the magic items had prefixes and suffixes that would change the stats. What it did show you, though, as it talked about the weapon, showed you in the margin graphical depictions of how the weapons would get as they get stronger. And as you got to the back end of the manual, this did what every Blizzard game did. It gave you a whole section of in-universe lore. The main focus of it was the Herodric Order, which are the group of people that kind of trapped Diablo in the bottom of this church well to begin with. It also dealt with the primeval, so Diablo and his brothers and all the battles that they would go through, their challenge to kind of take down the high heavens. A little bit about the world of Sanctuary, which is the world that this game takes place in. But again, it was all in-universe. It was all written from the perspective of one of the characters. And it just draws you in. It just captures you right away and puts you in the feel for the game. I'm going to link to a copy of the manual in the description of the episode, so check out that link. Give it a read through. This is how manuals should be done. This is manuals done right. This is a prime example for me. Now, when we're looking at the impact Diablo has had, it's very easy to just spiral out and look at every action RPG that it's influenced. I talked about that a little bit last episode to give you an idea of how broad the genre's become. But at its core, I just want to look at a few different influences that it's had, kind of look at how the franchise itself has evolved over time. So looking at Diablo, the franchise, you had Diablo 2 and Diablo 3, both of which have had expansion packs. Looking at kind of the growth of it as a whole, as I said, Hellfire put in the ability to see the items. In Diablo 2, they added a limited amount of running based on a stamina stat that you had, so you could run, but it would eat up that stat. When that stat was eaten up, you were back to walking. Diablo 2 also added socketed items. They added, basically, you could add gems and rune words to enhance your gear and make it even more powerful than it is. It allowed for some more customization, it allowed for some more specialization to your character so that your character is not the exact same as another character carrying the same gear, depending on what you have hooked into it. With Diablo 3, running just became a standard at that point, and your actual speed scaled with your level, so the higher level you are, the faster you're going to move. The other thing it did, Diablo 3 actually took out the stat progression for you to determine. So instead of assigning stat points to your character, you're now just assigning skills, putting points into skills. The stats themselves evolve normally. Diablo 2, they kept it as a combination of the two. You would get your character level stat points and you would get your character level skill point to assign. The other thing Diablo 3 did as almost a tribute to it this past year, being the big anniversary for Diablo, they recreated the original run of Diablo using the Diablo 3 engine. So you poured into this zone. The town's already been ruined. It kind of takes place between the intro to Diablo 2 and the action of Diablo 2, so the town's ruined but not completely burned to the ground yet. But you go in there, it suddenly degrades the graphics a little bit. It fixes you to your walk animation. So you're still moving at your running speed, but it's using the walk animation just to kind of nod to how you could not run in the original game. They use the monsters that are in Diablo 3 to do their best to recreate Diablo 1, and they use the tile set to do their best to recreate it. It's not a perfect recreation, but it was a fun little nod, and they do give you achievements for completing certain things that you could throughout it that require a little bit of randomness involved on it. The other thing in Diablo 3 is they did officially introduce the monk class, which was definitely based on the one from the Hellfire expansion for Diablo 1. And it was kind of a nice little thing to see it come in again and see it nodded. A lot of people didn't pick up on that, but the old fans, the ones who were there for Diablo 1, the ones that had played Hellfire back in the day, really knew where that had come from in the first place. There were even some of the classes in the expansion pack for Diablo 2 had some nods and had some ideas pulled from the monk. Another game that was created was Torchlight and Torchlight 2. That's probably one a lot of people are more familiar with than even Diablo 1. That company, Runic Games, was actually opened by two of Blizzard North's co-founders, the two brothers that founded Blizzard North. And it is very much a loving tribute. It is an evolution on the ideas from Diablo and Diablo 2. Definitely has a lighter tone, a more cartoony graphic style than this one did. Not a bad game. I would absolutely recommend playing it. If you're ever getting a Diablo itch but you don't want Diablo itself, this is a great way to scratch that. And then there's the other one I want to talk about, the other two actually together, are some free-to-play games that are out there. You have Path of the Exile and you have Marvel Heroes, which very different styles of games, very different looks to them, but both of them really show how that Diablo formula has been applied nowadays. Both of them embrace the loot grinding nature, the resource grinding nature of the Diablo game. So you have to kill a ton of things to get money. You have to kill a ton of things to get gear. You don't always know if that gear is going to be good for you or for somebody else. And Marvel Heroes goes a little bit of a different direction as well, where it allows you to grind for more characters to play as. When you start the game, you get one or two characters to start with, and you have to earn more either by paying real cash, which you can do, because it's a free-to-play game and they need a resource somehow, or you can take the time. It'll take you a long time to do, but you can take the time grinding it out, getting the items you need to unlock whatever character you want. Like I said, not an in-depth look at every effect Diablo's had on the genre, because Diablo kind of established the genre for what it was. Personally, I don't know if I could recommend Diablo 1 to most new players. If you haven't played it before, you're not going to have the same nostalgia. And I found that nostalgia really is what kept me going during some of the slog in the game. Some of the mechanics are a little old. Some of the gameplay styles are very old, very dated at this point, that it may not be something I would recommend people to play. What I would recommend is Diablo 2 and Diablo 2 Lord of Destruction, which is the core game and the expansion pack they put out for it. You can get them online at the Blizzard shop for $20 total. And honestly, they are the best of Diablo 1. And some of the features that didn't make it to Diablo 3 probably should have. They're still in this as well. There's enough depth. There's enough gameplay. There's a bit more speed and a bit more modern features there. I think you would have a great time playing it. Otherwise, I would point you to Torchlight 2, which is, again, it's basically Diablo 2 with a lighter style to it. Between the two, I would lean towards Diablo 2, though. If you're going to play a Diablo game, start with that. Work your way from there. So that's it for Diablo. Thanks for joining us on this episode. If you want to reach out to us, please do so. You can do it on Twitter at Roadmap Podcast or come by the website roadmappodcast.com. Feel free to suggest any older games you think we should play on the show. Share some of your favorite memories or even just ask us questions. Always happy to answer. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, leave a review, ideally 5 stars. If you think it's less, give it less. Include some text feedback when you do. It's the only way we're going to get better here. Next month, at the end of the month, our big game that we're going to be playing is the Artificial Life Simulator Creatures. In the meantime, you can check back at the second Tuesday of next month. We'll be taking a bit more of an in-depth look at the artificial life genre as a whole and emergence-based simulations as well. Thanks for listening.